sure.
On the line. Mm-hmm. We have a gentleman here as our guest speaker tonight, is from Division 14,
I have a cannon.
Watertown.
Thanks.
He's a well-known historian and sports announcer, John Horrigan. He's going to talk about the wreck of St. John's.
What I like about the Hibernians, they love God and they love Guinness. Happy St. Patrick's Day. As Dick said, my name is John Horrigan. It's great to be here. I'm known as a historical raconteur, and also I'm a professional sports announcer part-time. So if I break out into my hockey voice, that's because I'm the voice of the Boston Bruins alumni. I've been with them for 18 years, and I also do New England Patriots basketball. I'm going to talk to you about the wreck of the St. John, which happened in the year 1849. But in order to preface that, I have to tell you about what led to people getting on board the St. John. Now, you all know about the blight. It's known as Phytophthora infestans, and I always have to wipe my mouth. That's a scientific name for the potato blight. In the autumn of 1845, a fungus-based potato disease reached Ireland from South America on the border of Peru and Bolivia. Nearly half of the Irish population was entirely reliant upon the potato, especially in the west of Ireland. In the west of Ireland, the illiteracy rate in some counties was over 50%. Those who lived in subhuman living standards was also in the 50% range. Well, this blight spread during the wet spring and summer of 1846, causing an almost total failure of that year's potato crop. In 1847, many people had of necessity eaten their seed potatoes, and the overall crop was again disastrously low. 1848 saw yet another crop failure, and in 1849 and 1850, the blight was less severe. Well, during the time of the famine from 1845 to 1851, it's estimated that over 1 million Irish people died of starvation and the diseases that followed. Nearly 2 million emigrated mostly to Canada, the United States, Australia, and England. The catastrophe was almost entirely borne by the labor and small farmers who, because of their circumstances under the heels of the British landlords, had nothing but the meager potato crop that they had planted to sustain life. Everything else they earned, everything, went to rent and the barest necessities. During the height of the genocide, and that's what this is, only one crop had failed, and many were unaffected, except those in the west of Ireland. Relief efforts were stymied by the British government at every level. British landowners would rather see cattle and sheep on their land than Irish peasants. And when I'm talking about Irish peasants, I'm talking about Catholics. And they made sure that these evictions happened through cold strategy while staying within the tenancy laws. During the crises, as hundreds of thousands of Irish people were dying of starvation and its effects, crops and livestock were actually exported out of Ireland to England. Foreign relief from the United States of America and elsewhere was routed through English ports where taxes were extracted and precious time was wasted before they could reach Ireland. Humanitarian, life-sustaining aid that civilized societies normally provide to those in need was denied by the British to the Irish on the grounds that such relief would spoil them in the future. Now, normally this lecture is about an hour, and I rail on about the famine queen. And when I'm talking about the famine queen, I'm talking about a woman who hung around way too long. That's Queen Victoria. She turned a blind eye to the crisis in Ireland. She only contributed £5,000 to the famine relief effort. That's £70,000 by today's standards. Another guy, Lord John Russell, and his ministry committed what I call democide. It's a deliberate policy of negligence rather than of a planned killing. So in 1841, the population of Ireland was 8.2 million. By 1851, 10 years later, it was less than 6 million. Now, you hear a song called The Fields of Athenry, or Athenry. There you go. I'm relying on my Irish brothers and sisters to help me out here. Well, anyways, it was popularized by the Boston-based rock band, and let's give a shout-out to Ken Casey and the boys, the Dropkick Murphys. My brother Jeff Horrigan wrote the song, the Red Sox ballad, Tessie, so they have a place in there, yeah. But the song talks about Michael, who's deported to Botany Bay after stealing corn to feed his starving family. In that song, you hear the mention of Trevelyan and Trevelyan's corn. Trevelyan's corn mentions the grain that's rotting in silos on Irish and British docks while they're extracting taxes. Well, Charles Edward Trevelyan, now if you want to put your finger on somebody that was really responsible for exacerbating the starvation, he's a senior British civil servant in the administration of the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in Dublin Castle, and he's one of what I call one of the culprits, the primary culprits of inaction, as his reports to London totally understated the severity of the famine and insisted that problems would arise if the starving were helped in any way. Remember that name, Charles Edward Trevelyan. Well, landlords wasted no time in legally evicting Irish tenants from their homes, even though there was no possibility for them to make rent payments. Eviction was likely to mean certain death, with absolutely nowhere to go except to live in ditches, which were known as scalpines. Did I say that right? Scalpines. Emigration was the only option for the lucky few and was also prone to end in death of typhus or cholera, or as human cargo in steerage on the ghastly, they're called coffin ships or famine ships. And that's what the St. John is. So people are forced out of their houses and into the frigid, damp, cold Irish air. And I'm sure many of you have been there and you know what I'm talking about. The key to survival is staying warm and dry, and it's nearly impossible to do so in the Irish winters. There are attempts to halt these evictions, but these riots by the peasants were always brutally suppressed by loyalists to the Briton. Enter the St. John. St. John was a brig. It displaced about 200 tons, and it was owned by Henry Comerford of Galway. The captain was a spirited chap named Martin Oliver. He was also from Galway. There was a crew of 10, including the captain, and there were 110 passengers from North Clare and Connemara. Well, one of the other factors into play with the wreck of the St. John, and we all know what just went on a few days ago. Can you say nor'easter? What, we had six of them already here? Well, racing up the coast of New England, and one of my specialties is historical meteorology, comes a gale, and it's known as the Great October Gale of 1849. Well, rain began to fall along the New England coast at 6 o'clock on Saturday, October 6, 1849. By midnight, a violent gale was blowing from the northeast, and the rain was falling in torrents. By Sunday, October 7th, telegraph lines, trees, and chimneys were down, and sea vessels were being driven onto the land. Just to give you some perspective with 1849, telegraph was only in use for about 5 years. And there was a telegraph wire running from Boston down the south shore of Massachusetts. The first railroad line was opened in 1849 in Pennsylvania. So you have very primitive telegraph service, although it's in place, and very primitive railroad service as well. Well, due to the wind and rain, all of the telegraph communications to the south of Boston ceased. The lines were down. In Chelsea, just down the road from here, one of the walls to the Universalist Church was blown completely over. 2 inches of snow fell in Temple, New Hampshire, which is just 10 miles north of the Massachusetts border. So the St. John leaves Galway, Ireland on September 5th, 1849. She made Cape Cod Light at 5 o'clock on Saturday evening, October 6th, 1849, an hour before the storm hit. So she's sitting off of Cape Cod, and the captain, in some dreadful, tragic irony, throws down the anchor, Captain Oliver, and he passes out a ration of grog, which is a rum concoction. He says it to his crew and to the passengers, and he says, "I suggest that you all celebrate your final night on board the St. John." And he wasn't kidding. At 1 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, October 7th, 1849, the St. John stood away northward from Scituate Light, about 2.5 miles out to clear the land until light. In other words, she was waiting for the storm to abate before she approached land. As you know, the New England coast is rocky. Well, she remained there about to the first light, about 4 in the morning. Well, the storm was very, very brutal. The waves are heavy. And when the dawn began to break, Captain Oliver tacked, and the St. John stood south-southwest, with the captain calling the weather, quote, very thick. Well, the ship was being driven southward towards Cohasset Bay, so she came inside Minot's Ledge, where a lighthouse was inoperable and still under construction. Anybody familiar with Minot's Light? Well, tragically, that was under construction, and it wasn't first lit until January 1st, 1850, which is about 3 months after our story. And it was actually destroyed in April 1851 in what's known as the lighthouse storm, when two lightkeepers stayed valiantly in the top of the light. They rang the bell at 1 in the morning, and then the lighthouse was toppled and they were swept away. So as you approach Cohasset Harbor, you have what's known as the Grampuses, which is near Minot's Ledge. And the Grampuses and the Glades have taken many, many ships over the past 200 years. John Smith, the famous explorer, actually traded gunfire for arrows with the Indians living there, the Cohasset Indians there. But it's now 6:30 in the morning on October 7th. And Captain Oliver suddenly sees another ship off in the distance. It's the British brig Kathleen, and it's anchored near Hooksett Rock, which is part of the Grampuses. And he decides, like any good Irishman would do, he's going to lend assistance to a ship in peril. But he found that he couldn't fetch up to her and assist her, and she was now foundering badly, listing to the left, listing to port. Well, he throws over both of the St. John's anchors, and at 7 a.m., they begin to drag anchor. They're in trouble. She began to drift swiftly towards Grampus Ledge, and her sails now were shredded. And again, you have 120 people on board, 10 crewmen and 110 passengers. Captain Oliver then decides, and it's a last-ditch effort to save a vessel in the 19th century, is to cut away the masts to make the ship lighter. Meanwhile, on the shore of Cohasset, this event is being witnessed by residents of the Glades House. And I had the fortune of actually attending a party there right out off the coast of Cohasset and looking out at where this wreck took place. And they could hear the people calling for help, and they could see the ship was in trouble, and there was nothing that they could do. Enormous breakers repeatedly lifted up the ship and hurled her against the rocks repeatedly. The captain, who would survive, would later recall that these waves were mountains high. A hole was broken in the hull, and those below deck, including some of the wealthier passengers, were drowned instantly. Then the brig began to break up. People now gathered on the shore, and they were horrified to see people being swept off the deck of the St. John by the dozens and into the boiling surf. Even though the wind howled and the surf pounded the shore, witnesses swore that they could hear the screams of the victims. I'm going to pass this around, but this is what showed up the artist's rendering of the wreck of the St. John in Harper's Weekly in October of 1849, if we want to send that down the tables there. And you can look it up online if you look at the wreck of St. John, and you'll see my article about it. Well, anyways, the jolly boat, and this is a type of side boat, is hanging by its tackle alongside the stern when the rigging broke, and it's at the back of the ship, and it fell into the water and was being swept away. Captain Oliver, unselfishly, along with the second mate and two of his crewmen, who were just two young apprentice boys, they jumped into the maelstrom to try and secure the jolly boat. Just as they were about to reach the jolly boat and secure it, 25 passengers jumped off of the deck into the water and swamped the boat, capsizing it. Only Captain Oliver survived as he grabbed a rope that was thrown to him hanging from the quarterdeck of the St. John, and he was pulled aboard by the ship's mate and the nephew of the ship's owner, Henry Cumberford. Next, they had the longboat. This is another secondary boat. It was launched, and several passengers jumped into the water but didn't reach her. None did. They all drowned. People clung to the wreckage and were slammed onto the barnacle-clad rocks. The captain, the first mate, a man by the name of Crawford, and the remaining crew members, I guess seven is what I'm counting here, and the only one passenger reached this longboat. So a lifeboat now, meanwhile, the life-saving crew, and these are brave, brave men. These are the guys that look like the Gorton's fishermen with the floppy rain hats, and they have the longboat, and they'll go out in any condition. Well, they launch a lifeboat, except they head towards the brig Kathleen. They think that the people are off the St. John and that they're all safe and that it's the Kathleen that's in peril. Ironically, all the people have got off the Kathleen and were ashore by now. Now, the wind is howling, the salt spray is in their face, And they couldn't see through the spray and howling wind and didn't realize that nearly 110 people were in peril. By 4 o'clock on the 7th, 27 bodies washed ashore in Cohasset, 21 women, 3 men, and 3 children. Austin Kern, Catherine Flanagan, Betsy Higgins, Mary Kane, Michael Fitzpatrick, Michael Gibbon, Barbara Keneally, Mary Slatterly, Michael Redding, Honora Cullen, Honora Burke were among the people who were saved. And in fact, those last names still exist in the Cohasset area today. Patrick Sweeney of Galway perished along with his wife and 9 children. A Mr. Lathrop, a kind soul who lived in Cohasset, he sheltered the survivors in his house. And he waded into the surf to retrieve a parcel of clothing. He found that it was a bound-up mattress. Well, he cut open the mattress and realized that he had an infant alive in his arms. That infant was later nursed back to health. The St. John was in charge by 8 o'clock that morning. 8 women and 7 men made their way to the shore, almost dead of exhaustion. 21 people were saved. 99 people drowned. Some had to have their hands pried off of the flotsam to which they were clinging. People like Mr. Holmes, a railroad conductor, lined the shore anxious to help rescue the living and retrieve the dead. All 7 first-class passengers were lost, including 3 nieces of the ship's owner, Mr. Comerford. A man clung to a timber with his mouth open, his skin a deep purple, his fixed teeth, and his eyes a-bulging. By nightfall, 46 bodies were recovered. So the story is now published in the Boston Bee. And a man who was very famous in the 1850s, some call him the rock star of the 1850s, transcendentalist, naturalist, author, Henry David Thoreau, decides to take a trip down to Cohasset. He was leaving with a friend and they were going to walk down to Cape Cod. And I have a lot of respect for Thoreau, but for this story, I do not. Later, this story is captured in a story, a short story that's published posthumously called The Shipwreck. But this long diatribe, this drivel of an article written by Thoreau, I came to the conclusion that all he wanted to do was poke a dead, bloated body with his stick. To you, Henry David Thoreau, why don't you go back in the woods where you came from? Finally, the reason why I want to tell you about this story is in Cohasset, the Central Cemetery, on May 30th, 1914, a memorial cross was erected by our ancient order of Hibernians, and it stands there today. That's my talk. Happy St. Patrick's Day. God bless each and every one of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick.